Hello and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning Utah news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Today, the latest meeting of the Utah Inland Port Authority draws critics and counties seeking development opportunities. The San Juan County Commission calls on President-elect Joe Biden to fully reinstate the Bears Ears National Monument. And Utah's troubled teen industry gets some coaching on how to protect itself from investigations. On the phone for this discussion, we have Jessica Miller, who is legal affairs reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. And good morning, Jessica. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you.
Also on the phone, we have Tribune government reporter Taylor Stevens. And good morning and welcome to you, Taylor.
Good morning.
And later in the show, we are going to hear from San Juan County reporter Zach Podmore. Listeners, as always, we invite you to join us with your questions or comments about the stories that we are discussing. You can tweet those comments and questions to @KCPW, or you can call us. The number is 801-355-8255. Again, that's 801-355-TALK. All of these stories are equally weighty. Jessica Miller, let's start with you and a major industry here in Utah that has been under scrutiny, the youth treatment center industry, something you've been covering for a while. The Tribune has documented quite a number of allegations of mistreatment or abuse in some of these facilities. And just before we get to the news of this week, remind us what it is that we're talking about when we say youth treatment or troubled teen industry in the state. How big of an industry is it here in Utah?
So this is a very large industry here in Utah. Generally, these like troubled teen industries, it's residential treatment. So if there's a kid who is having problems, sometimes their parents will pay, or like the foster care system, or someone will pay for them to come to Utah, and they go to these facilities where they're supposed to be receiving treatment. But we've been documenting instances of, you know, a lot of students coming out of this system and saying that they didn't get the treatment that they were promised, that it was more of an abusive environment, whether that was mental abuse. But there's also been allegations of physical abuse, sexual assault, things that are much more serious going on in these facilities. Hmm.
Just going back to the definition of what these places are, is the therapy that they are offering, you know, the kids who are sent to these facilities, I mean, is it therapy that they're offering, or what kind of treatment are we talking about when we say youth therapy?
I think it depends. I mean, this is a very large industry, and there's kind of different ways that it kind of presents itself. Like, you kind of see sometimes maybe there's a ranch in a part of rural Utah where the therapy is just doing farm work or taking care of horses. And then there might be other places where there's more actual therapists working with the kids and things like that. So it kind of depends on the facility. Most of them do say that they give some sort of therapy in some fashion or another.
The celebrity Paris Hilton in August said that as a teenager, she was abused at one of these facilities in Utah. Another reason for some heightened attention of late on this story. The news on this front this week, Jessica, some advice, some counsel that administrators of these facilities got during an online meeting. Someone leaked audio of this meeting to you. Maybe you could tell us who was participating in this meeting and what it was about.
Yeah, so there is a National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs. It's called NATSAP for short. And basically, this is an association that these troubled teen facilities pay to be a part of, and they get, you know, training and advice, things like that as part of this organization. So this organization had a web meeting, and during this meeting, the director brought up some concerns that Utah's Disability Law Centers and other similar organizations in other states are starting to investigate these troubled teen facilities and trying to document these abuses so that more oversight or changes can happen in the industry.
Okay. So the advice being offered is having to do with these disability law centers launching investigations. And actually, can you just tell us, you know, what a disability law center is? They have different names in different states. Here in Utah, it is the Disability Law Center. Who are these organizations?
So these organizations are federally designated as what's called a protection and advocacy organization. So it gives them some federal funding, but more importantly, gives them access to these facilities. These are mostly for-profit private institutions, but as this designated, they call it P&A agency, they can go into these facilities if they have a legitimate concern there's abuses going on, and they can go have access to the students and the records and the facility and things like that, and they can document those instances of abuse if that's happening. The idea being that people with disabilities might not have advocates for them, and so the federal government has designated these law groups in every state as the advocates who can act on behalf of people with disabilities.
Well, Megan Stokes, who is executive director of this this industry, the quote unquote troubled teen industry trade organization, the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs, she was presenting in this call, and she gave a number of pieces of advice to administrators of these facilities. Early on in this recording, she offers a kind of a clue or a heads up to be on the lookout for. Take a listen.
Please find out if you do not already know. Please find out if you have had an increase in record requests over the last 2-3 weeks. If you have, you can talk to me privately, you can talk to me publicly, however you want to do that, but I want you to really pay attention. It is a sign that the Disability Law Center or Disability Rights, whatever, is actively looking at your program.
Okay, and so Jessica Miller, the idea here is basically, know when you're being scrutinized?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's different ways to look at this. Like when I talked with Megan, she said this was just advice. Like there wasn't anything nefarious about this. But when you talk with child advocates, they've raised concerns that maybe this advice was more how to skirt accountability and how to keep the Disability Law Center out so that they can't come in and document allegations of abuse.
Okay, right. So people are trying to expose the things that are happening in your facility, and you want to keep that opaque. Is the concern you're seeing from people who are trying to conduct these, these sort of investigations? I mean, and we should say that the Disability Law Center has launched the Utah Disability Law Center in October launched an investigation into this industry or into specific therapy locations in this industry. Is that correct?
Yes. And, with this industry, especially in Utah, it is just a huge industry. There's almost 100 facilities in the state. There's been 12,000 children in the last 5 years coming in and out of these programs. So kind of figuring out where to start an investigation like this can be a little bit challenging. From my conversations with them, it seems like they're kind of just looking at this right now, hearing, allegations from former students. They haven't gotten to the point yet where they're zeroing in on a certain facility or trying to get inside, but they're obviously concerned. Say it's a little bit troubling to hear Stokes' advice to these troubled teen facilities.
It's interesting. Any industry is going to try to protect itself, and Stokes, the executive director of this trade group, she doesn't see these investigations as, as well-meaning. In fact, here, let's play another clip from this call. This is a description that she gives of disability law centers around the country. Just take a listen.
They operate under the assumption that even if there isn't smoke, there's still fire. So the program is hesitant to provide information or access to records. They will assume that's probable cause.
And so, Jessica, again, an industry, trying to protect itself, and I want to ask some overarching questions about the fears of these investigations and maybe even how this call came together. But first, actually, I want to play one more clip that shows the level of protection and of basically secrecy that this trade organization is operating under or is recommending that these facilities operate under. Just one more clip from that same online meeting, and then we'll come back to Tribune legal affairs reporter Jessica Miller.
I would ask that people, if you have questions about this, to call me or get a hold of, call myself, call the home office. Let's not email. That is something that would be discoverable if things go to court. if you want to talk to your licensor, you've got a good relationship with them, give them a call too. Don't put it in email.
So, Jessica, calls, not emails. We don't want to create an easy paper trail for those who would dig into our doings to follow. You know, I don't know if we need to go further into the context of this, you know, the size of the industry here in Utah. You also brought up some of the complaints against the industry or against specific locations. Was this meeting that you reported on, you know, after audio was leaked to the Tribune, was it because the industry is aware of the skeletons in its closet and wants to, you know, do something about that? Or, you know, you've been reporting on this for years, or was it something else? I mean, what we're hearing is that the industry sees a kind of plot against it by these disability law centers.
Right. And some of the context of this meeting is missing from the recording that I received. But Megan, when I asked her about this meeting, she said that it basically was in response to, we've had a lot of very high profile rallies, you know, with Paris Hilton and her documentary coming out. She came to Utah, came to Provo and led a protest. And so that's kind of got everybody in this industry kind of on high alert. And during the protest, a lawyer from the Disability Law Center spoke to the crowd. And so she said that the meeting or this conversation was because a lot of these facilities didn't understand what the Disability Law Center was and what a P&A agency was and what kind of access they could have. And so she said that this was just to kind of explain the process and what the Disability Law Center is and what it can and can't do.
And just one more time, the Disability Law Center here in Utah, how do they respond to what is happening in this meeting?
I mean, they're obviously, they've called it a little bit troubling. They're obviously some concern. And, you know, the Disability Law Center in Utah, they don't just look at youth treatment centers. They've been in jails. They've been in adult long-term facility or long-term care facilities, especially with like coronavirus and stuff going on. They've gotten access into those places to make sure that people with disabilities are being treated fairly. And generally, he said the experience so far has been people are pretty open to this. You know, people want to be or want to have transparency if there's abuse or neglect or anything like that going on. They want to get to the bottom of it in their facilities. So it's concerning that perhaps that same openness won't be there for them once they start to dig in deeper into this troubled teen industry.
I mean, it's an interesting industry because you're dealing with people in a period of transition in their lives. Teens are already a sort of volatile group to deal with. And then you throw in other, I guess, sort of issues along the lines of addiction or behavioral problems. And I wonder if there's not just in the industry itself a kind of degree of inevitability of conflict. I mean, that obviously doesn't result in other kinds of abuse happening. I guess maybe you could remind us, there is a campaign, a fair amount of attention to shut down these some facilities in particular, for example, the facility that Paris Hilton attended. Can you just remind us what the sort of scope of the allegations is one more time, Jessica, and then we'll probably have to head to a break here shortly.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there's just some of these places where obviously you're dealing with kids with certain issues. That's your business. That's why they're there. And so obviously some of that behavioral issues will come into play, but we've seen places and we've done data analysis, the Tribune has, where there are places that just generally have higher than average reports to police of sexual abuse, reports to police of physical abuse. There are places that do seem to be more problematic as far as staff just harming children in restraints, overusing medication, isolation and things like that. So those sorts of things are happening at certain facilities more than others.
I have so many other questions, Jessica. For example, you know, who are the employees of these facilities who are carrying out the abuse that the Tribune is documenting? How are they hired and so on? But I think we need to leave it there just in the interest of time and move on to other stories. So, Jessica Miller, I'll direct people to your reporting at sltrib.com. Jessica Miller is Salt Lake Tribune legal affairs reporter. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we'll turn to the latest news on the Utah Inland Port and on the proposal for satellite ports around the state. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Jessica Miller and Taylor Stevens. It's our Friday morning news roundup. You can call us to join this conversation. The number is 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to @KCPW with your questions and comments. Taylor Stevens, Tribune government reporter. An inland port is a sort of system of warehouses where goods can clear customs, but far from any shipping terminal on the coast. Utah, the state of Utah, that is charging full steam ahead to develop its inland port and envisions it as a sort of export terminal as well. The Utah Inland Port Authority Board held its quarterly meeting this week, and just a basic question before we get to the action of this meeting, Taylor, is where are we in the process of the development of the inland port? Are we, you know, square one, the 50-yard line? Is it sort of hard to say?
I think it's hard to say, especially because the port envisions this as a really long-term project that, you know, can continue to shift and grow and change depending on needs for logistics around the state. So there's no, like, end point here as far as, like, you know, 2030, this is going to be completed. And so it is hard to say, but, you know, taking that long view of this project, we really are in the early phases, and we have seen the port board slow down a lot as far as, you know, they used to be having monthly meetings. Now they're meeting quarterly. At this meeting held Wednesday, we didn't see a whole lot of action taken that is pushing the project forward. What it seems that the Port Authority staff and board are doing right now is conducting research and trying to get a better picture of what the movement of goods around the state looks like right now. And that's kind of where we are at this point.
Well, as you said, you know, a board meeting that happened this week, and the sort of thrust of this meeting was the development of, or consideration maybe, of satellite port locations. What is the satellite port model that they've got in the works, or that they're investigating maybe? Taylor, maybe you could actually explain where we are in the satellite port concept process.
Sure. So we've talked a lot on this show about the big inland port planned for Salt Lake City's northwest side, 16,000 acres near the Great Salt Lake. And the Port Authority and Port Board envisioned the satellite, or the inland port concept, as being more of a statewide kind of system. And so they've been looking at siting satellite ports in an effort to, you know, further benefit the movement of goods around the state, like I said earlier. And so where they are kind of in that process at this point is they have been gathering what they are calling asset mapping forms from different counties around the state. And the counties are giving kind of in each of those forms sort of their best case in a way for why they believe they would be a good port. So they're listing their access to rail, their access to major airports, their access to major interstates, you know, all these things that could help them move goods. Some of them have even made cases, you know, on their economies. So our economy's been struggling a lot with the pandemic, and, you know, having a satellite port in our area would really benefit the economy. So although the port board says that this is not a competition and that these are not applications for a satellite port to be placed somewhere, you definitely do get a feel within those documents for each of these counties making a case for why an inland port would be good in their area, a satellite port. And so that's kind of where that process is. They're still taking in those asset forms. They're hoping to get all of those in by the end of the year. They already have 10 of those in. And after that, the way we understand the process is they're going to go back to some of those communities to get more information about what they're calling the business case for placing a satellite port in a community. Mm-hmm. So the way they talk about it is, you know, it's not an if they build it, you know, if we build it, they will come kind of situation. It has to make sense with the way that goods move and the access that a community has, the imports and exports that are already coming to that area. And so there's a lot going on as far as that kind of behind the scenes work of, you know, getting up to speed. But as far as actually siting a port, and there's no real timeline for that, but it does appear that we are quite a ways out from some of that kind of action from the port board.
And I guess this meeting that took place this week, the quarterly board meeting, was that a chance for counties who are, you know, making the pitch? I know you talked about the documents that they were submitting saying we have access to rail or our economy is struggling or here's what we would do or might do. Were the counties in this board meeting making a pitch to the port board?
So several counties spoke during public comment, but during the official board meeting, what we heard from was more government economic development leaders, so leaders from the Association of Governments across the state, as well as they brought along with them a lot of rural business interests. And so they were kind of giving an update on this process, where it's at, and along the way, you know, making a case for why, again, this satellite port proposal would be so good for their economies. There was one real estate developer who spoke, Frank Nichols. He's in Cedar City. He said, you know, we couldn't be more excited about anything, and that this is the maybe the biggest thing that could ever happen to Southern Utah would be a satellite port. And so just a lot of that kind of, update as far as where this process is at, but also, again, that case for, you know, here's why this is really important to our economies. And it does appear, you know, in a way they're kind of preaching to the choir, because the port board is on board with this plan and has been espousing it as well.
A lot of excitement, a lot of hype from counties that you're pointing out there and from developers and so on. There's also, of course, and has been since the beginning, quite a lot of opposition. And that was on display during this this quarterly meeting, right? How did the meeting take place, Taylor? Was it in person? Was it on Zoom?
Yeah, it was virtual. And, you know, a lot different covering virtual meetings during this time.
Yeah.
One of the challenges of covering virtual meetings is that you never know how many people are going to speak during public comment, whereas when you're in a room, you can kind of see, okay, there's 50 people here. If all of them speak, we've got about 50 minutes. But, you know, the public comment just kept going and going during the meeting Wednesday, almost 2 hours worth of public comment. Most of it, people who were opposed to the port, although that was interspersed with commentary from county commissioners who were promoting the satellite port concept. But most of the opposition is coming from people in the Salt Lake Valley who remain concerned about the impacts this development could have. And this has been called the state's largest ever economic development project. So they're concerned about impacts on air quality, climate change, the West Side, wildlife. They've got a lot of concerns, and they came out again on Wednesday to express those. And in a way, you know, this is kind of deja vu with sort of the same concerns being put forward over and over that we've seen at every meeting that the Inland Port Authority Board has had for the last few years.
Deja vu all over again, to quote Yogi Berra. Taylor, you actually, speaking of quotes, you quote Dorothy Owen, who is chairperson of the West Point Community Council, in your article, who spoke at this meeting, and she notes the responsiveness of the board, meaning the port, the Inland Port Authority Board, to rural governments, and then how that kind of contrasts with the way that municipalities around the hub of this hub and spoke satellite port model, like her own, the way that they have been treated. Can you explain what she was talking about there, Taylor?
Yeah, so just going all the way back to 2018, when this bill creating the Inland Port was passed, it was done with very little debate. over the objections of leaders in Salt Lake City who were concerned about some of the particulars of the bill. And so people in Salt Lake City feel like they didn't have much of a voice in this process and that this was kind of thrust upon them. Whereas in a law that was kind of updating the first bill that created the port, I believe in the 2019 legislative session, but it could have been 2020. Time is just like not linear right now.
Right.
But the state legislature created the satellite port system, and as part of that, said that for a county or a private landowner to host a satellite port, they had to first get consent from a governmental body or private landowner. And so that's something that Salt Lake City never got. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of why Dorothy Owen, as you mentioned, chairperson of the West Point Community Council, feels that the response has been different because she sees a really different level of engagement and transparency and work ahead of time before citing it a port that Salt Lake City never got.
And there was a lawsuit over that was challenging the takeover of land and a lot of land that used to be in Salt Lake City's jurisdiction. There was a lot of, again, people who were, as you said, upset about that original action to take over the land, but also environmental impacts. A lot of that opposition about or having to do with the environmental impacts of the port was on display at this meeting as well. And a specific call that a number of those speaking made was for the port to conduct a human health risk assessment. What would that do, Taylor?
Yeah, so what they want to see is really a study of how this would impact health and particularly an analysis of pollution that would be generated by the vehicle, rail, air traffic, truck traffic that would be generated by the port at different stages of its development, specifically with PM2.5 air pollutants is what they're hoping to see. This is kind of an interesting call from the Stop the Polluting Port Coalition, which has often been focused on abolition. They want, abort the port is something that they often talk about at their rallies. And this is more of a reform that they're asking for. The port board didn't really speak to this call at all because all of these comments came during public comments. So it's not really clear if this is something that they are going to do or interested in doing. But that was something that a lot of the people who spoke at the meeting were calling for and would like to see as this project moves forward.
You point out in your article that, no action was taken during this meeting. And as far as choosing satellite sites, we've got a long ways to go in that process, as you said. And I remind listeners that you can join us with your questions and comments, 801-355-8255. And Taylor, I want to turn, before we head to a break, to a related story. And this is one that you covered this week. It has to do with one of the places seeking to lure the inland port to I was going to say shores, but this is inland, so to its land, its boundaries, whatever. Green River. You wrote that the mayor of Green River admitted to what he said was a boo-boo, and it had to do with his spending some money on doing that wooing of the inland port board. Can you explain what happened there?
Yeah, this is a really interesting story in that it does not initially appear to be related to the inland port. So Travis Bacon had used city money to pay $17,000 to his friend, Scott Banaski, who is the owner of a local hunting lodge in the area. He hadn't pre-approved the deal with the city council. He hadn't received any invoices. And so this first came up among city council members who were concerned about these payments. Ultimately, we obtained invoices through a public records request that showed what the money was spent on. And $5,000 of it was spent on an inland port sporting clay and pheasant hunt is how it's described in the invoices. And so that was an event that was held in September. brought together some elected officials, some business interests, people who see the potential of developing a satellite port. And the proposal from the Emory County commissioners who put together that asset mapping form that I mentioned earlier, they want to see a nearly 9,000-acre port built in Green River. There's a kind of variety of composition of lands, but advocates were really concerned because some of the land is public Bureau of Land Management land that they're proposing. And this pheasant hunt, you know, wasn't advertised as a public meeting. That is creating some concerns, not only among the city council, but also among port opponents in the Salt Lake Valley, who, you know, find it troubling that these conversations are kind of happening behind the scenes.
Hey, Taylor.
Meanwhile,
I
was just going to mention, you know, meanwhile, the city interests say, and the port board says, you know, this was just kind of a run-of-the-mill, after-hours social meeting, and, you know, sometimes you got to have those conversations to bring something to town. And so Banaski kind of defended the payments and said that if Green River stays stagnant, then that's not good for anybody. But if Green River grows, then everybody in Green River will win, including him as the owner of the hunting lodge.
I'm just trying to get some of the basics of who was it, like who participated in this event that the $5,000 was spent on. Was it Inland Port Authority board members? I'm trying to figure out what took place.
Yeah, we know that there was Inland Port Authority board staff there. I haven't confirmed that anyone from the board was there, but there were also some county commissioners, a few state lawmakers who I believe were there, and some business interests as well. But we don't have a list. We haven't been able to obtain a list of people who were at that meeting, unfortunately.
And then this was, you know, one meeting or one event in Green River. Are there other counties and municipalities spending a whole bunch of money, however much money, whining and dining Port Authority board members to try and convince them, or their staff, I guess, to try and convince them to bring a satellite port to their municipality? Are there any college scholarships being handed out here, Taylor, to reference what's going on?
As far as we know, there's been at least one other meeting, and that one, I believe, was in Iron County. Port Authority staff say the city of Green River was chosen as a meeting location, not necessarily because that proposal has higher interest than others that have put forward these asset mapping forms, but because it's more of a central location to San Juan and Carbon County, so elected officials from different parts of the state could come together more easily. It does sound like they're going to be doing these site visits as they kind of move forward, that they will be doing those in other parts of the state. And again, I'll just mention that, you know, the port board says this clay shooting offer that they see it as an after-hours event and not so much as an inland port activity, that it just was kind of an offer presented during their official meetings and some people took advantage of it. But, you know, that does raise concerns for some people who have had long-standing worries that these conversations are happening behind closed doors and that the public isn't aware where this is headed.
And it was an event that the mayor wrote a $5,000 check for in the city, right?
Right, exactly, from city money and without having any invoices or clearing it with the city council, which is, another concern for a lot of folks.
Sure. Taylor, there's so much more we could get into in the story, and I know we'll come back to it, but for now, I will just say thank you. We need to head to another break in the show, so thanks for your reporting on this.
Thank you.
Again, that's Taylor Stevens, government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, and we're going to take another quick break. There's still more ahead. Including calls from a rural Utah government for the restoration of a national monument. This is Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough. We'll be right back.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Jessica Miller and Taylor Stevens. It is our Friday morning local news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. And I had meant to save time for a story about the Brigham Young University Police Department, which is facing decertification, an unprecedented sanction from for some actions that officers there took a couple of years back. BYU says that the move by the Department of Public Safety to decertify its police department is politically motivated. Unfortunately, though, we have run out of time, and so we're going to have to save that for another day. Jessica Miller, my apologies to you. Right now, we will turn instead to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week. And Jessica, because I've cut you short, I'll give you the first bite of the apple on the underplayed stories.
Well, thank you. I would like to point out this week, Courtney Tanner, education reporter, has really been doing a great job of reporting about the education system and coronavirus, whether that's been, that there's been a higher instance of high schoolers getting coronavirus versus younger kids, or at what point younger children will start getting the vaccine. So check out her reporting this week. It's been really good to read so far.
It's been awesome. Absolutely. Check that out at sltrib.com. Thank you, Jessica, for your pick for Underplayed Story. Taylor Stevens, government reporter, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
Yeah, I just want to highlight also our reporting and coverage of the vaccination. I know that has been giving me a lot of hope as we head into the winter. We've got a vaccine Q&A up from Andy Larson, our data reporter, and also Courtney Tanner's work on kids being vaccinated is worth checking out.
Check that out also at sltrib.com. Thank you, Taylor. For my part, did you guys hear about this monolith? No, I'm kidding.
No more monolith.
Yeah, no more monolith stories. End it now.
Not underplayed.
Well, speaking of buried trash, Lee Davidson has a story about the discovery that construction workers unearthed at a new UTA bus maintenance terminal that is going to happen, or facility that is happening in downtown Salt Lake City. They're building, and workers with Big D Construction unearthed a midden, which is a bunch of trash, a pile of trash, and it's from the 19th century, from back when the site was a maintenance shop for the Denver and Rio Grande Western Railroad. Some cool photos from that story, and you can check out the kind of old bottles of whiskey and weird old plates that may have been on train cars, as well as everything else that we've been discussing on the show today at sltrib.com. And Jessica Miller and Taylor Stevens, two reporters from the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining me today on the show.
Thank you.
Well, today we will wrap up with a conversation that features Zach Podmore, who is a Report for America Corps member covering San Juan County for the Salt Lake Tribune. He and I spoke about a new resolution passed by the San Juan County Commission. And yes, we did, in fact, also touch on that viral international news that came out of San Juan County this past week, the monolith. Anyway, here is our conversation. Zach Podmore, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on, Roger.
Yeah, appreciate it. On this show, you and I have occasionally talked about the San Juan County Commission and how its makeup has changed, basically how the power structure in that part of rural Utah has changed. A demonstration of that change in power came this week with the passage of a resolution by the San Juan County Commission. So what did that resolution say, Zach?
Yeah, that's correct. On Tuesday, the San Juan County Commission passed a resolution requesting the Biden administration to immediately take steps to restore Bears Ears National Monument to its original size as created by President Obama in 2016. It was, of course, reduced in 2017 by 85% by President Trump. So this isn't a big change in the county commission's position. They passed similar resolutions in 2019, showing the county's support for restoring and even expanding Bears Ears beyond the original designation size. But this is a direct resolution written for the incoming Biden administration to request they make that a priority.
I know I'm harping on a little bit older history here when I bring this up, but this is a complete reversal from what this very same commission, the San Juan County Commission, had to say 4 years back when they, opposed the creation of this monument. And that's pretty remarkable when you think about how full circle we have come. And I guess I'm wondering if you can remind us, Zach, how this change in political winds happened down there in San Juan County.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, in 2016, all three members of the San Juan County Commission opposed the designation of Bears Ears National Monument. It was two Republicans and a Democrat at that time. And they all, you know, joined Trump at the reduction ceremony in Salt Lake City in 2017. But in 2018, a ongoing voting rights lawsuit between the county and the Navajo Nation was resolved. A federal judge found that the county had been disenfranchising Native American voters in the county who outnumber white voters in the way that the commission districts were drawn. The judge ordered a special master to come in and redraw all three commission districts, and ordered a special election to be held in 2018. And that election brought in the first Democratic Majority Commission and the first Native American Majority Commission in the county's history, to members of the Navajo Nation who had advocated for the designation of Bears Ears National Monument were elected, and they immediately took steps early last year to reverse the county's official position on the monument and to show that the county was now supporting its designation and asking for it to be reinstated.
There was opposition to this resolution from this week, calling on the Biden administration to restore the full Bears Ears, and that came from one of the commission members, right?
That's correct. Yeah, Bruce Adams is a Republican from Monticello. He is he's been on the commission for over a decade, so he was there throughout the monument controversy in 2015 and in 2016, and he, you know, has been opposed to the monument the whole time, and he voted against this resolution asking for Biden to restore it.
This is going back even further than we've been talking about so far, Zach, but can you also remind us where the original proposal for the Bears Ears National Monument came from? I mean, it came from Utah, right?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. The original proposal came from a coalition of five Native American tribes with ancestral ties to the Bears Ears region. That's Hopi, Zuni, Navajo, Ute Mountain Ute, and Ute Indian tribes. And they originally proposed a 1.9 million acre national monument that stretched from, you know, the border with the Navajo Nation along the San Juan River in southern San Juan County, pretty much all the way up to Moab. Obama ended up designating 1.3 million acres, so considerably smaller than the original request from the tribes, and then President Trump reduced that to somewhere around 200,000 acres.
Do you think, is there any sign, Zach, as far as, do we have any signals as to how the Biden administration is going to receive this petition? Obviously, Biden was part of the Obama administration. Obama designated the monument. Should we expect the restoration of the original size of the monument?
A lot of people who would like to see the monument restored think it's going to be a priority for the Biden administration. It was a promise on the campaign trail. It's on his Joe Biden's website. He says he'll take immediate steps to restore Bears Ears and Grand Staircase National Monuments. So that's all the information I have is just what was said on the campaign trail, but it does seem like that would be a something that the new administration would, you know, take steps towards, and having this support from the local county commission would probably help with that. President Trump, and when he reduced the monument in 2017, said that one of his reasons for doing so was local opposition. So now, if officially that position has reversed, it's a little harder to make that argument.
It's interesting though, because there's this sort of back and forth and back and forth, and monuments are meant to be to a certain degree permanent, and there's management plans that go into them, and then a great deal of work behind it. I don't know if you can comment on this, Zach, but the process of going back and forth, is that undermining what the Antiquities Act is meant to do?
Well, as you know, within hours of the executive order from President Trump that reduced both Grand Staircase Escalante and Bears Ears National Monuments, the five tribes in the Intertribal Coalition and a number of environmental groups sued the federal government saying a president doesn't have authority to reduce a monument. It's not, you know, spelled out in the Antiquities Act itself. It's very clear that a president has the authority to create a national monument, but it doesn't say anything about reducing or removing or rescinding one. So this has been in the courts since 2017. It hasn't gone to trial yet. There have been some motions filed and that sort of thing, but it's not going to be resolved in the courts in the next few months, it doesn't seem like. So I think that's a question from both sides is how this relates to the legal question of whether a president does in fact have the authority to rescind a national monument or not.
It's interesting, and that may remain an open question because of the change in administrations. And so we may not get resolution on that. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's my understanding. And I think there's been some talk about possibly, amending the Antiquities Act in order to make it clear that a president can only create and not rescind a national monument. That, of course, hasn't passed through Congress yet, but I know that's been discussed. So it could either be clarified within the courts, by letting the court system decide what the law says, or it could be clarified through Congress of actually amending the law to make it clear.
Hey, there's this group, Utah Dene Bakaya, a pro-monument group. The executive director of that group, Woody Lee, was in favor of what the San Juan County Commission had to say. San Juan County Commissioner Willie Gray Eyes also, obviously spoke in favor of this because he's the commissioner who's helping to pass this resolution. I'm bringing both of those guys up because they both commented on this other reason that San Juan County made the news this week, and that's because of this. Well, viral doesn't really do it justice. This story that was centered in a part of San Juan County that, if I'm not mistaken, and you can correct me on this, Zach, if I am, used to be part of the Bears Ears National Monument. The monolith, I don't think we need to tell people all that much about it because everybody already seems to know everything there is to know about this. But some comments from Commissioner Willie Gray Eyes and from Woody Lee of Utah Dene Bakaya. What did they have to say about this bizarre viral thing that happened in San Juan County that you covered?
Yeah. yeah, that's correct. The site where this monolith was installed probably sometime in 2016 before the monument's designation became briefly part of Bears Ears National Monument for the year that it was at its full size before it was reduced. Yeah, I asked Commissioner Willie Gray Eyes about that yesterday. He said he said he hadn't been following the story too closely, but he'd heard about this metal box out in the desert that was causing all this hubbub. And he said it's a distraction from, what Bears Ears is really about, which is about indigenous connections to this landscape, which has so many cultural sites on it, so many sacred sites. And he said he hopes that, the focus returns to those connections when, people think and talk about Bears Ears instead of this odd piece of art that appeared and disappeared in the last few weeks and drew even more attention than the monument itself.
Well, and maybe we'll see that subside a little bit because of the fact that it's been taken down. And Zach, just quickly, you covered this story, the monolith story, start to finish. Did you ever imagine that would be part of your beat, Zach Podmore?
No, not at all. But as soon as I saw the first photos of it before the location was released, I had a feeling that it would be in San Juan County. And, San Juan County only has a little over 15,000 people, but it has a tendency to make its way into national and international news on a pretty regular basis. So I wasn't too surprised when it turned out to be in San Juan County. And it was nice to be able to actually go out there and see it and be part of the reporting that was done on it, since so many outlets across the world were reporting on it without any firsthand information, especially in the first few days. So I'm glad that the Tribune has me down in San Juan County and puts me on Bears Ears beat and the monolith beat when it occurs.
Zach Podmore I'll just wrap up here, man. You are a Report for America core member, and you write about conflict and change down there in San Juan County for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Good talking to you.
And again, that was Zach Podmore, who reports for the Salt Lake Tribune from San Juan County. He did have a lot of monolith coverage this week, including on the impacts of hundreds of people visiting a site that had pretty much been untouched before that installation became the viral story that it became. You can check out his coverage at sltrib.com. And if you just can't get enough coverage of the monolith, you can also go over to kcpw.org and find the KCPW program in the Hive. This week I spoke with a Utah artist who may or may not have been responsible for the thing, and also with the Reddit user who dug through Google Earth satellite images to find the monolith and then ended up making the location of the thing public after debating whether or not he should do that. We also heard from the head of the BLM field office in Monticello about, again, about those impacts of visitors to the site and so on. You can check that out at kcpw.org. And that does it for Behind the Headlines from KCPW, a listener-supported, entirely independent public radio resource. Podcasts at kcpw.org or however you get your podcasts. Stay safe out there as coronavirus infections continue to surge in Utah. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for tuning in, and join us again next week.